Chapter 3. All day long, people had been telling me that the weatherman said we were in for a dust storm. But I just assumed that dust storm meant that I'd have to tuck my scarf under the lower rim of my goggles the way I had been doing every time it got windy on the playa. But the dust storm that blew up after we left Zeb behind and returned to the nonstop circus was insane. The night turned white with flying dust, and our lights just bounced back in our faces, creating gloomy gray zones in front of us that seemed to go on forever. It reminded me of really bad fog, the kind of thing you get sometimes in San Francisco, usually in the middle of summer, reducing all the tourists in their shorts and t-shirts to hypothermia candidates. But fog made it hard to see, and the dust storm made it hard, nearly impossible, to breathe. Our eyes and noses streamed. Our mouths were caked with dust. Every breath triggered a coughing fit. We stumbled and staggered and clutched each other's hands because if we let go, we'd be swallowed by the storm. Ange pulled my ear down to her mouth and shouted, "We have to get inside!" "I know," I said. "I'm just trying to figure out how to get back to camp. I think we're around 9 o'clock in B." The ring roads that proceeded concentrically from center camp were lettered in alphabetical order. We were at 715 and L, way out in the hinterlands. Without the dust, the walk would have taken 15 minutes and been altogether pleasant. With the dust, well, it felt like it might take hours. "Screw that," Ange said. "We have to get inside somewhere now." She started dragging me. I tripped over a piece of rebar hammered into the playa and topped with a punctured tennis ball, someone's tent stake. Ange's iron grip kept me from falling, and she hauled me along. Then we were at a structure, a hexayurt made from triangular slabs of flat styrofoam duct-taped on its seams. The outside was covered with an insulating layer of silver-painted bubble wrap. We felt our way around the door, a styro slab with a duct tape hinge on one edge and a pull loop. Ange was about to yank this open when I stopped her and knocked instead. Storm or no storm, it was weird and wrong to just walk into some stranger's home. The wind howled. If someone was coming, I couldn't hear them over its terrible moaning whistle. I raised my hand to knock again, and the door swung open. A bearded face peered out at us and shouted, "Get in!" We didn't need to be asked twice. We dove through the door, and it shut behind us. I could still hardly see. My goggles were nearly opaque with caked-on dust, and the light in the hexayurt was dim, provided by LED lanterns draped with gauzy scarves.
"Look what the storm blew in,"
said a gravelly, jovial voice from the yurt shadows.
"Better hose them off before you bring them over here, John. Those two have got half the playa in their ears."
"Come on," said the bearded man. He was wearing tie-dyes and had beads braided into his long beard and what was left of his hair. He grinned at us from behind a pair of round John Lennon glasses. "Let's get you cleaned up. Shoes first, thanks." Awkwardly, we bent down and unlaced our shoes. We did have half the playa in them. The other half was caught in the folds of our clothes and our hair and our ears. "Can I get you two something to wear? We can beat the dust out of your clothes once the wind dies down." My first instinct was to say no, because we hadn't even been introduced. Plus, it seemed like more hospitality than even the gift economy demanded. On the other hand, we weren't doing these people any kindness by crapping up their hexayurt. On the other hand, that'd be so awesome, Ange said, "Thank you." That's why she's my girlfriend. Left to my own devices, I'd be on the other handing it until Labor Day. "Thanks," I said. The man produced billowy bundles of bright silk. "They're salwar kameez," he said. "Indian clothes. Here, these are the pants, and you wrap the tops around like so," he demonstrated. "I get them on eBay from women's clothing collectives in India, straight from the source. Very comfortable and practically one size fits all." We stripped down to our underwear and wound the silk around us as best we could. We helped each other with the tricky bits, and our host helped, too. "That's better," he said. and gave us a package of baby wipes, which are the playa's answer to a shower. We went through a stack of them, wiping the dust off each other's faces and out of each other's ears and cleaning our hands and bare feet. The dust had infiltrated our shoes and socks. "And that's it," the man said, clasping his hands together and beaming. He had a soft, gentle way of talking, but you could tell by the twinkle of his eyes that he didn't miss anything and that something very interesting was churning away in his mind. Either he was a Zen master or an axe murderer. No one else was that calm and mirthful. "I'm John, by the way." Ange shook his hand. "Ange," she said. "Marcus," I said. Lots of people used playa names, cute pseudonyms that let them assume new identities while they were at Burning Man. I'd had enough of living with my notorious alter ego Mikey and didn't feel the need to give myself another handle. I hadn't talked it over with Ange, but she too didn't seem to want or need a temporary name. "Come on and meet the rest." The rest turned out to be three more guys sitting on low cushions around a coffee table that was littered with paper, dice, and meticulously painted lead figurines. We'd interrupted an old-school gaming session, the kind you play with a dungeon master, and lots of role-playing. I'm hardly in any position to turn up my nose at someone else's amusements. After all, I spent years doing live-action role-play, but this was seriously nerdy. The fact that they were playing in the middle of a dust storm on the playa just made it more surreal. "Hi," Ange said. "That looks like fun."
"It certainly is," said a gravelly voice, and I got a look at its owner.
He had a lined and seamed face, kind eyes, and a slightly wild beard. He was wearing a scarf around his neck with a turquoise pin holding it in place.
"Are you initiated in the mysteries of this particular pursuit?"
I slipped my hand into Ange's and did my best not to be shy or awkward. "I've never played, but I'm willing to learn."
"An admirable sentiment," said another man. He was also in his 50s or 60s, with a neat gray Van Dyke beard and dark-rimmed glasses.
"I'm Mitch, this is Barlow, and this is Will, our dungeon master." The last man was a lot younger than the other three, maybe a youthful 40, and clean-shaven, with apple cheeks and short hair. "Hey, folks," he said, "you're just in time. Are you going to sit in? I've got some pre-rolled characters you can play. We're just doing a mini-dungeon while we wait out the storm." John brought us some cushions from the Hexayurt's recesses and sat down with crossed legs and perfect straight yoga posture. We settled down beside him. Will gave us our character sheets. I was a half-elf mage, Ange was a human fighter with an enchanted sword, and dug around in a case until he found hand-painted figurines that matched the descriptions. "My son paints them," he said. "I used to help, but the kid's a machine. I can't keep up with him." I looked closely at the figs. They were, well, they were beautiful. They'd been painted in incredible detail, more than I could actually make out in the dim light of the yurt. My character's robes had been painted with mystical silver sigils, and Ange's character's chainmail had each ring picked out in tarnished silver, with tiny daubs of black paint in the center of each minute ring. "These are amazing," I said. I'd always thought of tabletop RPGs as finicky and old-fashioned, but these figs had been painted by someone very talented who really loved the game, and if someone that talented thought this was worth his time, I'd give it a chance too. Will was a great game master, spinning the story of our quest in a dramatic voice that sucked me right in. The other guys listened intently, though they interjected from time to time with funny quips that cracked one another up. I got the feeling they'd known one another for a long time, and when we took a break for fresh mint tea, these guys knew how to live. I asked how they knew one another. They all smiled kind of awkwardly at one another. "It's kind of a reunion," Mitch said. "We all worked together a long time ago." "Did you do a startup together?" They laughed again. I could tell that I was missing something. Will said, "You ever hear of the Electronic Frontier Foundation?" I sure had. I figured it out a second before he said it. "These guys founded it." "Wait. Wait," I said. "You're John Perry Barlow?"
The guy in the kerchief nodded and grinned like a pirate. And you're John Gilmore?
John shrugged and raised his eyebrows.
And you're Mitch Kapoor?
The guy with the Van Dyke gave a little wave.
Ange was looking slightly left out.
Ange, these guys founded EFF. That one started the first ISP in San Francisco. That one commercialized spreadsheets. And that one wrote the Declaration of Independence of cyberspace.
Barlow laughed like a cement mixer.
And turned teraliters of sewage into gigaliters of diesel fuel with tailored algae. Also, I wrote a song or two since we're on the subject.
Oh, yeah, I said. Barlow also wrote songs for the Grateful Dead.
Anne shook her head. You make them sound like the elder gods of the internet.
Enough with the elder stuff, Mitch said and sipped his tea. You certainly seem to know your internet trivia, young man.
I blushed. A couple of times on the playa, people had recognized me as Mikey and come over to tell me how much they admired me and so on, and it had embarrassed me. But now I wanted these guys to know about that part of my life, and I couldn't figure out how to get it out without sounding like I was boasting to three of the all-time heroes of the internet. Again, Ange saved me.
Marcus and I worked with some EFF people a couple of years ago. He started XNet.
Will laughed aloud at that.
That was you?
He put on a hard-boiled detective voice.
Of all the yurts, in all the playa, they had to walk into mine.
Mitch held out his hand.
It's an honor, sir, he said.
I shook his hand, tongue-tied. The others followed suit. I was in a daze, and when John told me that he really admired the work I'd done, I thought I'd die from delight.
Enough, Ange said. I won't be able to get his head out of the door if it gets any more swollen. Now, are we here to talk or roll some goddamn dice?
I like your attitude, Will said, and thumbed through his notebook and set down some terrain tiles on the graph paper in front of us. Ange turned out to be a master strategist, which didn't surprise me, but clearly impressed everyone else, and she arrayed our forces such that we sliced through the trash hordes, beat the mini-bosses, and made it to the final boss without suffering any major losses. She was a born tank and loved bullying through our adversaries while directing our forces. Will gave her tons of extra XP for doing it all in character. Barbarian Swords Mistress came easily to her, and her example led us all. So by the time we got to the Dragon Empress in her cavern at the middle of the dungeon, we were all talking like a fantasy novel. Barlow was a master at this, improvising heroic poetry and delivering it in that whiskey voice of his. Meanwhile, Mitch and John kept catching little hints that Will dropped in his narration, discovering traps and hidden treasures based on the most obscure clues. I can't remember when we'd had a better time. Mitch and Barlow kept shifting on their cushions, and just as we broke through into the main cavern, they called for a stretch break and got to their feet and rubbed vigorously at their lower backs, groaning. Will stretched too and checked the yurt's door.
Storm's letting up, he called.
It was coming on to midnight, and when Will opened the door, a cool, refreshing breeze blew in, along with the sound of distant music. Part of me wanted to rush back out into the night and find some music to dance to, and part of me wanted to stay in the yurt with my heroes, playing D&D. That was the thing about Burning Man. There was so much I wanted to do. Will came over and handed me another cup of mint tea, the leaves floating in the hot water.
Pretty awesome.
I can't believe these guys let me DM their game. And I can't believe I ran into you. He shook his head. This place is like Nerdstock.
Have you known them for long?
Not really. I met Barlow and Gilmore a while back when I did a fundraiser for EFF. I ran into Gilmore at random today, and I told him I'd brought my D&D stuff along, and the next thing I knew I was running a game for them.
What kind of fundraiser were you doing?
Will looked familiar, but I couldn't quite place him.
Oh, he said, and stuck his hands in his pockets. They brought me in to pretend fight a lawyer in a Barney the Purple Dinosaur costume. It was because the Barney people had been sending a lot of legal threats out to websites, and EFF had been defending them, and, well, it was a lot of fun. I knew him from somewhere. It was driving me crazy.
Look, do I know you? You look really familiar.
Ha, he said. I thought you knew. I made some movies when I was a kid, and I was on Star Trek The Next Generation, and my jaw dropped so low, I felt like it was in danger of scraping my chest.
You're Will Wheaton?
He looked embarrassed. I've never been much of a Trek fan, but I'd seen a ton of the videos Wheaton had done with his comedy troupe. And of course, I knew about Wheaton's Law. Don't be a dick. That's me, he said.
You were the first person I ever followed on Twitter,
I said. It was a weird thing to say, sure, but it was the first thing that came to mind. He was a really funny tweeter.
Well, thank you, he said. No wonder he was such a good narrator. He'd been acting since he was like 7 years old.
Being around all these people made me wish I had access to Wikipedia so I could look them all up. We sat back down to play against the megaboss, the Dragon Empress. She had all kinds of fortifications and a bunch of lethal attacks. I figured out how to use an illusion spell to trick her into moving into a side corridor that gave her less room to maneuver, and this made it possible for the fighters to attack her in waves, while I used a digging spell to send chunks of the cave roof onto her head. This seemed like a good idea to me, and everyone else, I swear it, right up to the time that I triggered a cave-in that killed us all. But no one was too angry with me. We'd all cheered every time I rolled a 15 or better and one of my spells brought some roof down on the dragon's head, and no one had bothered too much about all those dice rolls Will was making behind his screen. Besides, it was nearly 1 a.m. and there was a party out there. We changed out of John's beautiful silk clothes and back into our stiff, dust-caked plyoware and switched on all our EL wire and fit our goggles over our eyes and said a million thanks and shook everyone's hands and so on. Just as I was about to go, Mitch wrote an email address on my arm with a Sharpie. There was plenty of stuff there already, playa coordinates of parties and email addresses of people I planned on looking up. Ange tells me you're looking for a job. That's the campaign manager for Joseph Noss. I hear she's looking for a webmaster. Tell her I sent you. I was speechless. After months of knocking on doors, sending in resumes, emailing and calling, an honest-to-goodness job with a recommendation from an honest-to-goodness legend. I stammered out my thanks, and as soon as we were outside, I kissed Ange and bounced up and down and dragged her off to the playa, nearly crashing into a guy on a dusty Segway tricked out with zebra-striped fun fur. He gave us a grin and a wave. We didn't see Masha or Zeb again until the temple burn on Sunday night, the last night. We'd burned the man the night before, and it had been in-freaking-sane. Hundreds of fire dancers executing precision maneuvers, tens of thousands of burners sitting in ranks on the playa, screaming our heads off as fireballs and mushroom clouds of flame rose out of the man's pyramid. Then the open-throated roar as it collapsed, and the rangers dropped their line, and we all rushed forward to the fire, everyone helping everyone else along, like the world's most courteous stampede. I flashed on the crush of bodies in the BART station after the Bay Bridge blew, the horrible feeling of being forced by the mass of people to step on those who'd fallen, the sweat and the stink and the noise. Someone had stabbed Daryl in that crowd, given him the wound that started us on our awful adventure. This crowd was nothing like that mob, but my internal organs didn't seem to know that, and they did slow flip-flops in my abdomen, and my legs turned to jelly, and I found myself slowly sliding to the playa. There were tears pouring down my face, and I felt like I was floating above my body as Ange grabbed me under my armpits, struggling to get me to my feet as she spoke urgent, soothing words into my ears. People stopped and helped, one tall woman steering traffic around us, a small older man grabbing me beneath my armpits with strong hands, pulling me upright. I snapped back into my body, felt the jelly-legged feeling recede, and blinked away the tears. I'm sorry, I said. Sorry. I was so embarrassed I felt like digging a hole and pulling the playa in over my head, but neither of the people who'd stopped to help seemed surprised. The woman told me where to find the nearest medical camp, and the man gave me a hug and told me to take it easy. Ange didn't say anything, just held me for a moment. She knew that I sometimes got a little wobbly in crowds, and she knew I didn't like to talk about it. We made our way to the fire and watched it for a moment, then went back out into the playa for the parties and the dancing and forgetting. I reminded myself that I was in love at Burning Man and that there might be a job waiting for me when I got back to San Francisco, and kicked myself in the ass every time I felt the bad feeling creeping up on me. Temple Burn was very different. We got there really early and sat down nearly at the front and watched the sunset and turned the temple's white walls orange, then red, then purple. Then the spotlights went up, and it turned blazing white again. The wind blew, and I heard the rustle of all the paper remembrances fluttering in its nooks and on its walls. We were sitting amid thousands of people, tens of thousands of people, but there was hardly a sound. When I closed my eyes, I could easily pretend that I was alone in the desert, with the temple and all its memories and goodbyes and sorrows. I felt the ghost of that feeling I'd had when I'd sat in the temple and tried to clear my mind, to be in the present and throw away all my distractions. The temple had an instantly calming effect on me, silenced all the chattering voices in the back of my head. I don't believe in spooks and ghosts and gods, and I don't think the temple had any supernatural effect. But it had an absolutely natural effect. Made me sorrowful and hopeful and calm and, well, soft-edged all at once. I wasn't the only one. We all sat and watched the temple. And people spoke in hushed tones, museum voices, church whispers. Time stretched. Sometimes I felt like I was dozing off. Other times I felt like I could feel every pore and every hair on my body. Ange stroked my back, and I squeezed her leg softly. I looked at the faces around me. Some were calm, some softly cried. Some smiled in profound contentment. The wind ruffled my scarf. And then I spotted them, three rows back from us, holding hands, Masha and Zeb. I nearly didn't recognize them at first, because Masha had her head on Zeb's shoulder and wore an expression of utter vulnerability and sadness, absolutely unlike her normal display of half-angry, half-cocky impatience. I looked away before I caught her eye, feeling like I had intruded on her privacy. I turned back to the temple, just in time to see the first flames lick at its insides, the paper crackling, and my breath catching in my chest. Then a tremendous column of fire sprouted out of the central atrium, whooshing in a pillar 100 yards tall, the heat and light so intense I had to turn my face away. The crowd sighed, a huge, soft sound, and I sighed with it. There was someone walking through the crowd now, a compact woman in goggles and gray clothes in a cut that somehow felt military, though they didn't have any markings or insignia. She was moving with odd intensity, holding a small video camera up to one eye and peering through it. People muttered objections as she stepped on them or blocked their view, then spoke louder, saying, "Sit down!" and "Down in front!" and "Spectator!" This last with a vicious spin on it that was particularly apt, given her preoccupation with that camera. I looked away from her and tried to put her out of my mind. The temple was burning along its length now, and someone near me drew a breath and let out a deep, bassy, "Om," that made my ears buzz. Another voice joined in. And then another, and then I joined in, the sound like a living thing that traveled up and down my chest and through my skull, suffusing me with calm. It was exactly what I needed, that sound. And as my voice twined with all those others, with Ange's,
I felt like a part of something so much larger than myself. A sharp pain in my thigh made me open my eyes. It was the lady with the camera, facing away from me, scanning the fire and the crowd with it, and she'd caught some of the meat of my thigh as she stepped past me. I looked up in annoyance, ready to say something really nasty, and found myself literally frozen in terror. You see, I knew that face. I could never have forgotten it. Her name was Carrie Johnstone. I'd called her Severe Haircut Woman before I learned it. The last time I'd seen her in person, she'd had me strapped to a board and ordered a soldier hardly older than me to waterboard me, to simulate my execution, to torture me. For years, that face had haunted my nightmares, swimming out of the dark of my dreams to taunt me, to savage me with sharp animal teeth, to choke me out with a tight bag over my face, to ask me relentless questions I couldn't answer and hit me when I said so. A closed-door military tribunal had found her not guilty of any crime, and she'd been transferred to help wind down the forward operating base in Tikrit, Iraq. I had a news alert for her, but no news of her ever appeared. As far as I could tell, she'd vanished. It was like being back in my nightmares, one of those paralysis dreams where your legs and arms won't work. I wanted to shout and scream and run, but all I could do was sit as my heart thundered so loud that my pulse blotted out all the other sounds, even that all-consuming ohm. Johnstone didn't even notice. She radiated an arrogant disregard for people, her face smooth and emotionless as the people around her asked her or shouted at her to move. She took another step past me, and I stared at her back, tense beneath her jacket, coiled for action. As she strode back through the crowd, disappearing over the horizon, hair beneath a stocking cap that was the same desert no color as her clothes. Ange squeezed my hand. "What's wrong?" she asked. I shook my head and squeezed back. I wasn't going to tell her I'd just seen the boogie woman on the playa. Even if that was Johnstone, so what? Everyone came to Burning Man, it seemed. Software pioneers, fugitives, poets, and me. I hadn't seen any rules against war criminals attending. "It's nothing," I choked out. I looked over the crowd. Johnstone had disappeared. I turned back to the burning temple, tried to find the peace I'd felt a moment before. By the time the temple burned down, I'd nearly convinced myself that I'd imagined Johnstone. After all, it had been dark, and the only light the erratic flicker of the temple. The woman had held a camera to her face, obscuring it, and I'd seen her from below. I'd been visiting all my ghosts that night, seeing the faces of friends lost and betrayed and saved in the temple's fire. I'd only seen the face for a moment. What were the odds that Carrie Johnstone would be at Burning Man? It was like finding Attila the Hun at a yoga class, like finding Darth Vader playing Ultimate Frisbee in the park, like finding Megatron volunteering at a children's hospital, like finding Nightmare Moon having a birthday party at Chuck E. Cheese. Thinking up these analogies, and even dumber ones that I won't inflict upon you, helped me calm down as Ange and I walked slowly away from Temple Burn with the rest of the crowd, a solemn and quiet procession. "Going home tomorrow," I said. "Exodus," Ange said. That's what it was called at Burning Man, and it was supposed to be epic. Thousands of cars and RVs stretching for miles, being released in pulses every hour so that the traffic didn't bunch up. We'd scored a ride back with a Lemmy from Noisebridge, the hackerspace I hung around at in San Francisco. I didn't know him well, but we knew where he was camped and had arranged to meet him with our stuff at 7 a.m. to help him pack his car. Getting up that early would be tricky, but I had a secret weapon, my contribution to the Burning Man gift economy, a.k.a. cold brew coffee. You've had hot coffee before, and, in the hands of a skilled maker, coffee can be amazing. But the fact is that coffee is one of the hardest things to get right in the world. even with great beans and a great roast and great equipment, a little too much heat, the wrong grind, or letting things go on too long will produce a cup of bitterness. Coffee's full of different acids, and depending on the grind, temperature, roast, and method, you can over-extract the acids from the beans or overheat them and oxidize them, producing that awful taste you get at donut shops and Starbucks. But there is another way. If you make coffee in cold water, you only extract the sweetest acids, the highly volatile flavors that hint at chocolate and caramel, the ones that boil away or turn to sourness under imperfect circumstances. Brewing coffee in cold water sounds weird, but in fact, it's just about the easiest way to make a cup or a jar of coffee. Just grind coffee, keep it coarse with grains about the size of sea salt, and combine it with twice as much water in an airtight jar. Give it a hard shake and stick it somewhere cool overnight. I used a cooler bag loaded with ice from Ice Camp and wrapped the whole thing in bubble wrap for insulation. In the morning, strain it through a colander and a paper coffee filter. What you've got now is coffee concentrate, which you can dilute with cold water to taste. I go about half and half. If you're feeling fancy, serve it over ice. Here's the thing. Cold brew coffee tastes amazing. It's practically impossible to screw it up. Unlike espresso, where all the grounds have to be about the same size so that the high-pressure water doesn't cause fracture lines in the puck of coffee that leaves some of the coffee unextracted and the rest over-extracted, cold brew grounds can be just about any size. Seriously, you could grind it with a stone axe. Unlike drip coffee, which goes sour and bitter if you leave the grounds in contact with the water for too long, cold brew just gets yummier and more caffeinated the longer the grounds sit in the water. Cold brewing in a jar is pretty much the easiest way to make coffee in the known universe, if you don't mind waiting overnight for the brew, and it produces the best tasting, most potent coffee you've ever drunk. The only downside is that it's kind of a pain in the ass to clean up. But if you want to spend some more money, you can invest in various gadgets to make it easier to filter the grounds, from cheap little toddy machines all the way up to hand-blown glass Kyoto drippers that look like something from a mad scientist's lab. But all you need to make a perfectly astounding cup of cold-brewed jet fuel is a mason jar, coffee, water, and something to strain it through. They've been making iced coffee this way in New Orleans for centuries, but for some unknown reason, it never seems to have caught on big time. All week, I'd been patrolling the playa armed with a big thermos bottle filled with cold brew concentrate, pouring out cups to anyone who seemed nice or in need of a lift. Every single person I shared it with had been astounded at the flavor. It's funny watching someone take a sip of cold brew for the first time, because it looks and smells strong, and it is, and coffee drinkers have been trained to think that strong equals bitter. The first mouthful washes over your tongue, and the coffee flavor wafts up the back of your throat and fills up your sinus cavity, and your nose is all, "This is incredibly strong!" And the flavor is strong, but there isn't a hint of bitterness. It's like someone took a cup of coffee and subtracted everything that wasn't totally delicious. And what's left behind is a pure, powerful coffee liquor made up of all these subtle flavors. Citrus and cocoa and a bit of maple syrup, all overlaid on the basic and powerful coffee taste you know and love. I know I converted at least a dozen people to the cult of cold brew over the week, and the only challenge had been keeping Ange from drinking it all before I could give it away. But we'd have jet fuel in plenty for the morning's pack-up and exodus. I'd put up all the leftover coffee to brew before we went to the temple burn. And if we drank even half of it, our ride would have let us out of the car during the exodus pulses to run laps around the playa and work off the excess energy. Thinking about this, I took my thermos off my belt and gave it a shake. "Want some magic bean juice?" I asked. "Yum," Ange said, and took the flask from me and swigged at it. "Leave some for me," I said, and pried it out of her fingers and drank the last few swallows. The deep, trance-like experience of Templeburn had left me feeling like I wanted to find someone's pillow camp and curl up on a mountain of cushions. But it was my last night on the playa, and I was going to dance. So I needed some rocket fuel. Just as I lowered the flask, I spotted Masha and Zeb again, walking stiffly beside each other, faces set like stone, expressionless. They were at least 50 yards away from me in the dark of night, and at first I thought they were just in some kind of deeply relaxed state from the extraordinary events of the night, but I soon saw that there was something definitely wrong. Walking very close behind them were a pair of large men in stocking caps, just like the one Carrie Johnstone, or her twin, had been wearing, and they had tight gray-black scarves pulled over their faces, though it wasn't blowing dust just then. The crowd parted a little, and I saw that they were dressed as Carrie Johnstone had been, the same semi-military jackets and baggy pants and big black boots. There was something wrong with them, and I couldn't place it for a moment, but then it hit me. They were dark tarts. No EL wire, no lights, and for that matter, Zeb and Masha had gone dark. I saw all this in a second and mostly reconstructed it after the fact because I was already moving. This way, I said to Ange, and grabbed her hand and started to push through the crowd. There was something really wrong with that little scene, and Masha might not be my favorite person in the world, but whatever was going down with her and Zeb and those two guys, I wanted to find out about it. Even as we pushed through the crowd, part of my brain was already telling me a little story about how it would all be okay. It's probably not even them. Those two guys probably have EL wire all over their clothes, but they're saving battery. Boy, is Angie going to think I'm a paranoia case when I tell her what I thought I saw. The four were heading out into the dark of the open playa now, and there was someone bringing up the rear, emerging from the crowd behind them. It was Carrie Johnstone, and I saw her profile clearly now, silhouetted by the orange light of a flamethrower flaring a fireball into the night as a mutant vehicle zoomed past. There was no doubt at all in my mind now. This was her. She was sweeping her head from side to side in a smooth, alert rhythm, like the Secret Service bodyguards that shadowed the president when he saw him on TV. Ange was saying something, but I couldn't hear her, and she was pulling on my hand, so I let go of her, because I knew it was Carrie Johnstone, and I knew that Zeb and Masha were under her power. I had been under her power. So had Ange. I knew what that meant, and I wasn't going to let her snatch anyone else. All five of them were vanishing into the night, and I began to push and shove my way through the crowd, not caring anymore if I stepped on someone's toes or bumped into them. People swore at me, but I barely heard them. My vision had shrunk to a narrow tunnel, with Carrie Johnstone at the end of it. I patted at my utility belt and found my thermos, which was made of hard metal alloy. It didn't weigh much, but if you hit someone from behind with it as hard as you could, they'd know they'd been hit. That's what I was going to do to Carrie Johnstone. I was making a wordless noise. It started off quietly under my breath, but it was quickly turning into a roar. No, not a roar. A battle cry. For years, this woman had haunted and hunted me in my dreams. She'd humiliated me, broken me, and now she was doing it again to someone else. And I had her in my sights and in my power. Someone on a playa bike nearly ran me down, but swerved at the last moment and fell over right in front of me, clipping my shin. I didn't even slow down. In fact, I sped up, leapt over the bike, and took off at a run. I'd never run like that in my life. A flat-out sprint with my feet barely touching the ground. I was just taking another step when the whole night turned hellish orange around me, and then there was a terrible whoof sound, and a blast of heat and noise and wind lifted me off my feet and threw me face first into the dust. I was dazed for a moment. We all were. And then I rolled over and picked myself up. My nose was bleeding, and when I put my hand up to it, it brushed against my lip, and it felt weird, numb and wet, and I thought in a distant, abstract way, I've really done a number on my face, I guess. That same part of me quietly chided myself for violating first aid protocol by moving around after an injury. Even if I didn't have a spinal injury or a concussion, I might have broken some small bone that hadn't had a chance to start sending pain signals to my brain yet. Might be mashing that broken bone under all my weight as I climbed to my feet. I told the voice to shut up. I remember that very clearly, actually thinking, "Shut up, you, I'm busy," like you do to a yappy dog. Because whatever had turned the sky orange, whatever had sent that gust of heat and wind and sound through the night, Carrie Johnstone had been responsible for it, and it had been part of her plan to take Zeb and Masha out. I knew it. Not in the way I knew what my address was, but in the way that I knew that a ball thrown straight in the air would come straight back again. A logical certainty. I set off back in the direction that Masha and Zeb and Johnstone and her goons had been heading, out into the darkness, limping a little now as my right knee started to complain loudly. I told it to shut up, too. They were gone. Of course they were. Unlit, moving fast, out there on the playa, they could have disappeared just by moving off 100 yards in nearly any direction. They probably had night scopes and all sorts of clever little asshole ninja super spy gadgets that they could use to avoid me if they wanted to. If she wanted to. Carrie Johnstone probably could have killed me without breaking a sweat, and I'm sure her goons could have done the same. They were some sort of soldiers, while I was a scrawny 19-year-old from San Francisco whose last fight had been settled in Mrs. Bapuji's daycare with a firm admonishment to share the Elmo doll with little Manny Hernandez. But I didn't care. I was on a mission. I wasn't a coward. I wasn't going to sit back and wait for other people to do all the work. So I lurched into the dark. There was no sign of them. I called out their names, screaming myself hoarse, running this way and that, and I was still running when Ange caught up with me, grabbed my arm, and pulled me bodily back to the infirmary tent. There were a lot of us there, waiting to be seen by the paramedics, nurses, EMTs, and doctors who streamed from across the playa to help with the aftermath of the worst disaster in the history of Burning Man. Octotank, the art car that exploded, had started out life as a ditch digger, and it retained the huge, powerful tank treads and chassis. A maker collective working out of a warehouse in San Bernardino had removed everything else and meticulously mounted an ancient octopus carnival ride atop it. You've seen the octopus rides, though your local version might have been called the spider, the Schwarzkopf monster, or the polyp. They've got 6 or more articulated arms, each one ending in a ride seat, sometimes just a chair with a lap bar, and sometimes a full cage. Now, that would have been cool enough, but then the mutant vehicle designers had mounted a flamethrower on the roof of each of Octotank's cars and hooked them up to an Arduino controller that caused them to fire in breathtaking sequences. They all drew their fuel from the same massive reservoir mounted to one side of Octotank's body, but each one had a mechanism that injected the fuel with different metal salts, and these impurities all burned with different bright colors. When Octotank was in motion, all 8 cars, swinging around in the night as it trundled across the playa, shooting tall pillars of multicolored flame into the sky from the swirling mandalas of its cars, well, it was magnificent. Right up to the moment it exploded, of course. The fuel reservoir was already half empty, thankfully. Otherwise, it would have done more than knock me and about 100 other people on my face. It would have incinerated us. Miraculously, no one was incinerated. Though a couple dozen were burned badly enough that they were airlifted to Reno. Octotank had been built by careful, thoughtful makers, and they'd put in triple fail-safes, the final measure being that the reservoir had been built with its thinnest wall on the outer, lower edge, so if it ever did blow, it would direct its force into the ground and not the driver or the riders. The force of the blast had knocked Octotank over, snapping off 2 of its arms, but the riders had been strapped down by their lap belts and had rolled with the vast broken mechanisms, getting scrapes and a few broken bones. As for me, my nose was broken. I had a pretty ugly cut to my forehead, and I'd bitten partway through my lip and needed 3 stitches. I had a sprained knee and a headache that could have been used to jackhammer concrete. But compared to a lot of the people who crowded in and around the infirmary camp that night, I'd gotten off light. Ange and I sat with our backs against an RV in the infirmary camp.
a woman in a pink furry cowboy hat and a glittering corset who'd identified herself as a nurse, asked me to stick close so that they could watch for signs of concussion. I didn't want to sit still, but Ange made me and called me an idiot when I argued. We didn't find out what happened right away. Couldn't have. We weren't looking at Octotank when it blew. Ange, being short, had been lost in a forest of taller bodies, trying to catch up to me. One of the reasons she didn't get hurt is that she was in among everyone else and found herself in the middle of a pile of people. Once she was sure that the people on the bottom were being seen to, she'd taken off again after me. I'd been running around in the dark, looking everywhere for Masha, Zeb, and the goon squad. So we got the story secondhand and thirdhand from people in the infirmary. There were lots of wild theories, and everyone was buzzing about the Department of Mutant Vehicles, which certified all the art cars on the playa, and which was staffed with legendary mechanics and pyrotechnicians. Could they have missed some critical flaw in Octotank's build? I didn't think so.
Chapter 4.
I convinced Ange to let me go and get some water from the infirmary's big cooler, my butt's getting numb, and took the chance to survey the human wreckage. It was terrible, and I thought I knew what had caused it. When I got back to Ange, I handed her my water bottle and watched her drink, then said, "Ange, if I told you something crazy, would you listen?" She rolled her eyes. "Marcus Yallo, you've been telling me crazy things since the night I met you. Have I ever not listened?" She had a point. "Sorry," I said. I leaned in close to her. "Back at the temple burn, do you remember a woman walking around with a camera right in front?" She shrugged. "Not really. Maybe?" I swallowed. What I was about to say sounded crazy in my head, and it was going to sound crazier out in the air, and it was just for starters. "It was Carrie Johnstone," I said. Ange looked puzzled for a moment, like she was trying to place the name. "Wait, Carrie Johnstone? The Carrie Johnstone?" I nodded. "I got a couple of good looks at her, I'm sure." I didn't sound sure. "I'm pretty sure." "So she's a burner now? That's weird." "I don't think she's a burner, Ange. I think she was here to kidnap Masha and Zeb." "Uh-huh," Ange said. "Marcus." "Damn it," I said. "You said you'd listen." She shut her mouth, opened it, shut it. "I did. Sorry. Go on." So I told her about what I'd seen. Zeb and Masha and the goons, and my stupid, half-baked attempt to catch them as they'd marched into the night. "So what are you saying?" "What do you think I'm saying, Ange? It sounds like you think that Johnstone and her pals kidnapped Masha and Zeb." I didn't say anything. Of course that's what I was thinking. But that was just for starters. I had another idea, one that was even more crazy sounding. I wanted to know, had to know, whether it would occur to Ange, too, or whether I just had my brains rattled when I face-planted into the gypsum flats of Black Rock Desert. "What?" she said. Then she opened her eyes a little wider. "You think that Johnstone blew up Octotank to... what, to cover her getaway?" I closed my eyes. I couldn't bear to look at Ange because she was staring at me like I was nuts. "Look at it this way. They've been driving fire-breathing art cars around the desert for decades now without a single major mishap. The first time one goes boom, it happens just as Carrie Johnstone, a war criminal with a history of ruthless disregard for human life, is in the middle of kidnapping a rogue agent who's been trafficking in giant troves of secret documents. The timing of the explosion is perfect, and 100% of the attention on the playa is occupied for the next several hours. Meanwhile, they could get away in a million ways. Hell, they could just stroll over to the trash fence and hop over it and leg it out over the mountains, or jump into a waiting car. The Black Rock Rangers will all be scrambling to help the wounded, not patrolling with night scopes for people trying to sneak in without a ticket." "Yeah," Ange said. "I suppose." She squeezed my hand again.
Or, people have been driving homemade flamethrower mobiles around the desert for decades, and it was only a matter of time until one blew up. And you saw someone, in the dark, do something that looked like a kidnapping, but at a distance. And right before you had your head knocked around and broke your nose, after a week's worth of sleep deprivation, recreational chemical use, and caffeine abuse. She said it calmly and evenly and kept hold of my hand as I struggled to go. Marcus, she said, grabbing my chin and forcing me to look into her eyes. I winced as she put pressure on the sutures in my lip, but she didn't loosen her grip. Marcus, I know what you've been through. I went through it too, some of it at least. I know that improbable things happen sometimes. I was there when Masha gave you her key. You have a right to believe what you believe. But, I said, I could hear there was a but coming. Occam's razor, she said. Occam's razor, the rule that says when you're confronted with a lot of explanations for a given phenomenon, the least complicated one is the one that is most likely to be right. Maybe your parents won't let you into the locked drawer in the bedroom because they're secret spies and they don't want you finding their cyanide capsules and blow dart rigs. Or maybe that's just where they keep their ew sex toys. Given that you know that your parents have had sex at least once, and given that in San Francisco at least, odds are good they've bought the odd dildo or two over the years, the super spy hypothesis has to be shuffled to the bottom of the pile. Or, to put it another way, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. I like Occam's razor, I said. It's a useful thinking tool, but it's not a law. Sometimes the unlikely happens. It's happened to both of us. I saw what I saw, and I saw it just a few days after I saw Masha, who is mixed up in all kinds of espionage stuff and who was acting paranoid as hell. Maybe she had a good reason for that. Yeah, and maybe all that stuff primed you to interpret things that happened in the days that followed in dramatic and scary ways. She let go of me and looked away at the crowds of people. Marcus, if you think you know what happened, you know what you should do. Masha told you what to do. If you ever hear that I've gone down or Zeb's gone down, release it. Shout it from the mountaintops. You know what? I hadn't even thought of that. I'd been so fixated on rescuing Masha, or proving I wasn't losing my mind, I'd totally forgotten that I was her insurance policy, that she'd fully expected that she might go down, and that she'd entrusted me with her personal countermeasure. Now that I thought of it, I found that the idea terrified me. I don't know what's in her insurance file, I said. But I've got an idea that if we were to make it public, it'd make some very powerful people very angry at us. I flashed on how I'd felt when Johnstone had been standing right over me, that paralyzing horror that started somewhere at the bottom of my spine and froze me to the spot. I believed that Johnstone had kidnapped Masha to keep the contents of that file a secret. What would she do to me if I released it? Worse, what would she do if Masha told her I had the insurance file? Oh, crap, I said. Oh, Ange, what'll we do? We both agreed that we didn't have to do anything that night. I was injured, we were in the middle of the playa without functional laptops, and, to be honest, we were both scared witless about the insurance file and what might happen if we were to go public with it. I still had the USB stick with me. I'd kept it in my utility belt in its little secure zip-up money belt section. I kept compulsively checking it until Ange made me stop. After a few hours, we decided that I didn't have a concussion and snuck away before anyone could disagree with us. We caught a few precious hours sleep in the tent, holding tight to each other, before the alarm on Ange's cheap, rugged plastic watch went off. Weep, weep, weep. And we got up to break camp and start Exodus. We'd slept in our clothes. It got cold at night in the desert, even with our sleeping bags zipped together for shared warmth. And when we got outside the tent and stood, I saw that my burnoose and the front of my t-shirt were crusted with dried blood from my broken nose and swollen lip. My nose and lip felt like they'd ballooned to elephantine proportions in the night, though when I brushed the dust off a nearby car's side mirror and checked my reflection, I saw that they were merely double their normal size. I looked like I'd been run over by a tank
one of my eyes blackened, my mouth distorted in a weird, pouty sneer, my taped-up nose misshapen and bulbous. "Ugh," I said, and my lip split again and began to seep blood. My face hurt. They'd given me some Tylenol 3s at the infirmary, and I took two of them, washing them down with cold brew, undiluted, straight from the mason jar, then kept on swigging at the bean juice. I needed energy if I was going to help Ange break down our camp and lug our gear across Black Rock City to the camp where the guy who was giving us our ride had been staying. Ange said, "You just sit down, Marcus. I got this." I shook my head and said, "No," a painful syllable that made my face bleed some more. "Forget it. Sit down." I shook my head again. "God, you're stubborn," she said. "Fine, kill yourself. Don't come running to me when you're dead." I waved at her and handed her the cold brew jar. She made a face. "There's blood in that one." I looked at the rim and saw it was smeared with red from my lip. I dug another jar out of the ice chest and passed it to her. She went to work on it. "Gotta drink plenty of water, too," she said. "Remember, this stuff is a diuretic." She was right. I alternated two swigs of water for every swig of cold brew at regular intervals over the next 45 minutes as I crammed, jammed, piled, and mashed our stuff into our bags. The biggest item to pack, by far, was Secret Project X-1 and all its assorted bits and pieces. When I joined Noisebridge, I hadn't really known what I wanted to do. All I knew was that these maker types had set up a hackerspace in the mission, filled it with lathes and laser cutters and workbenches and drill presses, and that anyone could join and use the gear to make, well, anything. I'd hung around for a month or two, dropping by after classes just to sit on the sofa and see what people were up to, bringing along my laptop and schoolbooks, and studying in between watching as my fellow Noisebridgers invented every mad and amazing thing under the sun. Noisebridge was a fantastic place. It had its own space program. Seriously, almost every month, they launched homebrew weather balloons crammed with cameras and instrument packages to heights of 70,000 feet and more and retrieved them. There were people hacking robots, cars, clocks, pet doors, toys, and rollerblades. Not to mention video game consoles, server hardware, autonomous flying drones, and so on and so on. And they had 3D printers. Devices that could produce actual physical objects on demand based on 3D files they made or downloaded from the net. Most of these had started off life as MakerBots, an amazing and popular open-source 3D printer kit that you assembled yourself. MakerBots printed in plastic, using spools of cheap plastic wire, and the results were pretty amazing, especially considering that the kits cost less than $1,000, and you could make one for less if you scrounged around for the parts in surplus catalogs and in the prodigious bins of spare electronics at Noisebridge. Being open source, MakerBots were a hacker's paradise, and people all over the world had modified their printers to do extraordinary and amazing things. The big excitement when I joined Noisebridge was a successful conversion to laser-based powder printing, which involved using an apparatus to spread a thin layer of plastic powder on the printing surface, then melting it into specific forms with a laser, then adding another layer of powder and melting it again with the laser, over and over, until you'd built up the whole solid shape. Powder-based printers cost a lot more than MakerBots, like $500,000 or more, and they were all locked up in a complicated set of patents that meant that only a few companies could make and sell them. But patents didn't stop people from modding their MakerBots to do powder, and once they started, it became the most popular form of MakerBot modding in the world. Naturally, it was. The objects that came out of a powder printer were much smoother and more detailed than the stuff that came out of a plastic wire printer. And, with a powerful enough laser, you could use metallic powders and produce precisely made objects in stainless steel, brass, silver, whatever you wanted. But what interested me wasn't printing in steel. It was printing in sand. There were lots of people around the world who were experimenting with alternatives to plastic or metal power as a printing medium because, well, anything you could melt with a laser could be fed into a printer. You could print the most wonderful stuff with sugar
or make brittle, tragically short-lived stuff out of the whey powder they sold in bulk for bodybuilding. But, like I say, sand was the stuff that caught my imagination. When you melt sand, you get glass. And a beautiful, streaky kind of glass it was. And every day brought more amazing sculptures and jewelry and action figures and, well, everything made of melted sand. As a printing material, sand was as cheap as it got, cheaper even than whey powder. But there wasn't any sand on the playa. What we had instead was dust. Gypsum dust, the stuff that they make drywall out of. In other words, stuff that you could, theoretically, make some wicked structures out of. That was my plan, anyway. I made my own MakerBot, downloading the plans from their site, laser-cutting the balsa wood, building the Arduino-based controller, scrounging parts when I could, buying them when I absolutely couldn't find them, but only through surplus stores. In the end, it cost me less than $200, and took me about 2 months, and it worked beautifully. As soon as I got it working, I promptly broke it, of course, and tried to get it running as a powder printer. That was a lot more complicated, and the powerful laser it required cost as much as the rest of the printer, but I got it working, too. And while I was gutting through that breakdown upgrade fix cycle, I hated every minute of it, felt like the world's biggest idiot for not being able to do something that everyone else, for some extremely specialized definition of everyone else, seemed able to pull off. But you know what? I couldn't stop. Because whenever something went wrong, it always seemed like the solution was tantalizingly within reach. And if I just did one more thing, I'd have it all working. One more thing, and one more thing, and one more thing again, and then, miraculously, it worked. I went from nearly comatose to elated beyond all reason in 1/1,000,000th of a second as the air above my workbench was filled with the sweet, toxic smell of melting sand and a bead of glass formed on the build platform. The bead took form, and my calibration test file, a block with several holes in it that were sized to snugly fit a collection of standard bolts I kept in my pocket for testing, began to take shape. I didn't need to use them. I could see that it was working. I'd taken that stupid printer apart and put it back together hundreds of times. I knew its movements like the movements of my own hands, and its sounds like I knew the sound of my own heart. I laughed and danced on the spot, for real, and watched it go through its paces for a few minutes before the excitement got to me, and I raced out onto Mission Street, ready to grab the first person I could lay hands on and drag them back to Noisebridge to see my machine working. Of course, as soon as I got out the door, I realized it was 3 a.m, and there was no one to be seen. So, that was my MakerBot. And the plan had been, what else, to mod it to print in playa dust, using melted sugar as a fuser. Sugar's strong. Melt some caramels and brush them onto a 2x4, and clamp another 2x4 to the spot overnight while the glue sets, and you'll get a joint that's so strong the wood will tear apart before the glue gives. But sugar is also water-soluble, so when I was done, my playa dust prints could be dissolved in water. Leave no trace, just like Burning Man Principle 8 says. I did some test runs, using powdered drywall that I ground up in an old hand-cranked coffee grinder, and I had it working pretty well when I disassembled the MakerBot and packed it up to take to the playa. That was Secret Project X1, and I swear it worked like a charm when I left San Francisco. I have no idea why it failed so miserably when we got to Black Rock City. The solar panels tested out good, and I borrowed a multimeter from another camp and checked every circuit and contact, and everything seemed to be in working order. But the stubborn, evil bastard refused to even turn on. Even bloodied and bruised and traumatized and terrorized, I still felt a pang when I packed away X1 again. I had this incredible plan to 3D print the most amazing shapes and objects out of playa dust. Fanciful animals, busts of famous monsters, all the best junk from Thingiverse, the online library of free 3D forms.
I was going to be the best, coolest, cleverest burner in the history of the playa. A legend. Instead, I was the guy who sweated and swore at his invention for 24 hours straight before his girlfriend went upside his head and told him to stop swearing at his printer and get out there and enjoy Burning Man. She was totally right, and everyone liked my cold brew. But man, it hurt to pack away X1 without having printed a single widget. "You'll get it working next year," Ange said. "Don't worry." She looked off at the cloud of dust rising from the playa as 50,000 burners packed up and got ready to turn Black Rock City back into Black Rock Desert, though there'd be cleanup teams staying behind for a few months, going over the whole desert, erasing the final signs of human occupation. "We have to go,"